Ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, for the study of conversion to Christianity in the insular world, a comparative look at the case of southwest Germany and the conversion of the Alamanni should be interesting for at least three reasons. Firstly, both Ireland and southwest Germany were converted to the new faith at about the same time, between the 5th and the 8th centuries. Secondly, there is an overall similarity of historical circumstances, as neither the Irish nor the Alamanni had ever been citizens of the Roman Empire, but after its downfall quickly adopted what had become the imperial state religion. And thirdly, there is of course the obvious link of people like Columbanus, who hailed from Ireland but was also active among the Alamanni. And moreover, the conversion processes in Ireland and southwest Germany are similar with respect to the lack of contemporary written documents, which leaves much room for speculation and consequently entails the danger of research being guided by wishful thinking, nationalist pride, denominational competition, or sheer romanticism. Like the Franks, or for that matter the Picts, the Alamanni appear for the first time in historical sources of the 3rd century. They may already have been mentioned by contemporary accounts referring to events that took place around 213 to the east of Mainz, but it cannot be excluded that their name was only interpolated in these accounts at a later stage. In any case, the Alamanni are well attested from around 260, when they began to move into the formerly Roman territories to the east of the Rhine and to the north of the Danube, that is to say present-day Baden-Württemberg or southwest Germany. So here you see, to the left, the distribution of early Alamannic settlements south of the Roman limes from the late 3rd to the late 5th century, and to the right, the geographical distribution of certain fibular types, which suggests that the newcomers had migrated from and were still maintaining links with regions further to the northeast, that's to say the area around the rivers Elbe and Saale. From around 500, the predominantly pagan Alamanni had to bow to the neighbouring Franks, who were ahead of them in taking to Christianity. And later tradition, beginning with Gregory of Tours, telescoped this development into the story of the Battle of Tolbiac, in which the Frankish king's vow to embrace Christianity resulted in the immediate intervention of heavenly hosts and the death of the Alamannic king. So this is how the French painter Paul-Joseph Blanc depicted the scene in a well-known fresco produced for the Paris Pantheon in around 1880. Now, unlike the French, for whom the Alamanni became the eponymous ancestors of the Germans, les Allemands, the Germans themselves discarded the name of the Alamanni in the late Middle Ages and only revived it as late as 1803, when the vernacular poet Johann Peter Hebel published his Alemannische Gedichte, Alemannic poems, which enjoyed an enormous popularity in the wake of the Romantic movement. To this day, the spirit of Romanticism makes itself felt in the popular idea that the inhabitants of present-day southwest Germany, such as myself, are the direct descendants of the Alamanni, speaking, as it were, the same language, although the variety of dialects known today as Alemannish cannot be traced back beyond the 9th century. Likewise, it is still popular to regard the Shrovetide customs of southwest Germany with their colourful masks as survivals from the day of paganism, although such customs are only attested from the late Middle Ages at the earliest. As a historical people of the late Roman and early medieval periods, the Alamanni still figure prominently in archaeological exhibitions where their name is usually associated with prehistoric burials, and in folklore festival parades, where it tends to be coupled with beer and Blasmusik. So this is, incidentally, this is in the town where I now live. They do that every year, and this picture is based, or is the result of participant observation this year. Now, many of these modern reenactments tend to focus on the belligerent aspects of a pagan warrior society. Not so very different from what you get in Britain, I suppose. However, I did manage to find these pictures of an itinerant insular monk baptizing an Alamannic lassie, which brings me to the central topic of my paper, what do we know about the Christianization of the Alamanni? Now, a convenient starting point for a discussion of this topic is a much-quoted passage which the Byzantine historian Agathias of Myrina wrote around the middle of the 6th century. I quote, "The Alamanni have their own traditional way of life, but in matters of government and public administration, they follow the Frankish system, religious observance being the only exception. They worship certain trees, the waters of rivers, hills, and mountain valleys, in whose honour they sacrifice horses, cattle, and countless other animals by beheading them, and imagine that they are performing an act of piety thereby. But contact with the Franks is having a beneficial effect and is reforming them in this respect too. Already it is influencing the more rational among them, and it will not be long, I think, before a saner view wins universal acceptance." End of quote. So from this passage it appears that by the middle of the 6th century, Alamannic society was still predominantly, though by no means exclusively, pagan. Archaeologically, Agathias' reference to the beheading of animals may be linked to the well-attested decapitation of horses in Alamannic burial rites. Nevertheless, his overall description of the pagan religion is rather stereotyped, reproducing typically Christian and classical clichés. A certain vagueness also characterizes the writings of the historian Ammianus Marcellinus, who relates how the Alamanni once missed a favorable opportunity to attack the Romans, speculating that this may have been because their auguries were inauspicious. Nor do we fare better when we look at the writings of later Christian authors, such as Jonas of Bobbio in his Life of St. Columbanus. Writing about the saint's sojourn near Lake Constance, Jonas says, again, I quote, "Once as he was going through this country, he discovered that the natives were going to make a heathen offering. They had a large cask that they called a cupa, and that held about 26 measures, filled with beer and set in their midst." On Columban's asking what they intended to do with it, they answered that they were making an offering to their god Woden, whom others call Mercury. When he heard of this abomination, he breathed on the cask, and lo, it broke with a crash and fell in pieces so that all the beer ran out. End of quote. Jonas goes on to tell us that the Alamanni immediately realized that there was no use crying over spilled beer, and thus were converted to Christianity. However, it is to be noted that Alcuin relates a very similar story about Saint Vedastus, Bishop of Arras, and some Frankish nobles, which appears to be modelled on the very story related by Jonas. So this reminds us that we should not overestimate the historical accuracy of such accounts, which in any case do not really go beyond showing what we knew before, namely that liquor could be used in pagan sacrificial rituals. Turning to archaeology, we are faced with a similar lack of evidence for Alamannic paganism, as there are no sanctuaries or sacrificial sites comparable to those that we find in northern Germany or in southern Scandinavia. Several iron objects discovered in Münchow-Homberg near Konstanz in 1938 are thought to be the remnants of a weapon sacrifice, but we know neither the people who offered up this sacrifice nor the deity to which it may have been addressed. In fact, most of what we do know about the religion of the pagan Alamanni is based on inferences drawn from graves and grave goods. One class of objects is thought to indicate a belief in the efficiency of charms and amulets, and possibly the idea that the dead were particularly in need of them. So, to the left you can see some objects found in the grave of a wealthy young lady buried in the late 4th century near the town of Laufen, where the cowrie shell is thought to be an amulet or charm rather than an object of decoration. To the right, you can see a variety of such charms and amulets culled from several Alamannic graves, objects including a perforated Roman bronze coin, two fragments of a Celtic glass armlet, a cowrie shell, and a bear's tooth. Food placed in graves is also thought to be characteristic of pagan ideas, as we may infer from the gradual abandonment of this custom in the wake of the Christianization. So here you see some pottery vessels from the already mentioned 4th century grave near Laufen, which also contained two sucking pigs and some grapes. Yet another indication of pagan ideas are multiple burials in a single grave, such as this example from Niederstotzingen, in which three individuals, two men and one woman, had been buried linking arms with each other in a single grave dating to the early 7th century. Moreover, We find horses buried along with their owners, such as this double burial, also from the town of Niederstotzingen. Occasionally, we find depictions of religious or mythological conceptions, such as these carvings of two-headed snakes on the lids of wooden coffins excavated in a burial field that was discovered in the early 19th century at Oberflacht near Tuttlingen. And I wonder if this is the Germanic cousin of the Nathir Dichen, the two-headed snake, which you get in one of the old Irish charms. Now, in some instances, such depictions can profitably be compared with similar finds from adjacent areas of the Germanic world, as is thought to be the case with an embossed golden disc found at the town of Plitzhausen. So here we see a mounted warrior who is just riding over his fallen enemy, aided by a presumably supernatural figure gripping the shaft of his spear. A rather similar depiction is known from a helmet plate found in one of the 7th century Valsgärde graves near Uppsala, where we also see a supernatural being guiding the spear of a mounted warrior riding over his fallen enemy. Likewise, an Alemannic sword sheath found at Gutenstein depicts what looks like a warrior dressed up as a wolf, in a fashion which is similar to the depiction on a helmet plate matrix found at Torslunda in Sweden. Sometimes it is assumed that we may identify individual deities, also known from written sources, as for instance in this bronze disc found in a grave at Heilfingen, where a central figure surrounded by eagles has been taken to represent the god Woden. All these identifications, however, are ultimately conjectural, based on inferences which are not always made transparent. Nevertheless, we do find the name of the god Woden, along with that of one, or possibly even two, other heathen deities, in a runic inscription on a fibula from Nordendorf in Bavaria. Moreover, another runic inscription on a fibula found near Balingen is thought to contain one of the ancient Germanic words for god, Ansuth. All told, however, we have to say that our knowledge of the pagan Alemannic religion, which was ultimately supplanted by Christianity, is both meagre and vague. Turning now to the earliest evidence for Christianity among the Alemanni, there is once more a conspicuous lack of written sources, so that here too we have to turn to graves and grave goods. Among the earliest and best known pieces of evidence are three silver discs, or phalerii, which were discovered in a wealthy mounted warrior's grave during the construction of a residential house near the town of Hüfingen in 1966. It is assumed that these three discs, which were probably produced in Italy or the Mediterranean area, formed part of a horse trapping, with the two discs showing a mounted warrior on either side of the third disc showing the Virgin Mary and the infant Jesus. The fact that the grave can be dated by dendrochronology to 606 makes these three discs the earliest Christian representations in southwest Germany known today. Similar finds can be adduced from other graves. Top left, you see an embossed silver disc from Kirchheim am Ries, which is thought to show two angels on either side of what looks like a processional cross, which is dated to the 7th century. Top right, you see a golden fibula shaped like a cross, found together with some other ornaments in a wealthy lady's grave at Lauchheim, dated to around 700. Bottom left, you see some cross-shaped silver fittings found in a wealthy lady's grave at Kirchheim am Ries, dated to 680, and bottom right, the fragment of a limewood casket with a drawing thought to represent two angels, dated to the 7th century. Among the most widespread Christian representations in graves are gold-leaf crosses, which were sewn on a kind of veil that was placed over the face of the deceased person, so that he or she might appear to kiss the cross. In general, these crosses are made of a single piece or of two pieces, the arms of the cross being usually of equal length, mostly between 4 and 8 centimetres long. The flimsy nature of these crosses, the lack of any marks of wear and tear, and the apparent haste with which they often seem to have been cut and decorated, all suggest that they were made immediately before the funeral. As far as we know, this custom began to be observed in the last third of the 6th century culminated in the 7th and was ultimately abandoned in the early 8th century. As regards runic inscriptions, the already mentioned Nordendorf fibula, frequently discussed, is by some scholars taken to be a Christian abjuration, meaning something like Woden and Dwigi Thonar are cheaters. This interpretation, however, hinges on the semantics of the first word, logathore, which is really opaque. Likewise, the runic inscription on a silver belt buckle found at Pforzheim in 1992 has been interpreted as a Christian abjuration, meaning Aegil and Aldrun have renounced the stags supposed to represent pagan stag masts, or alternatively, Aegil and Aldrun have renounced the lake god, or alternatively, Aegil and Aldrun have fought together with the stag in this case being taken as a symbol of Christ. In fact, all of these interpretations are highly questionable, as the verb gasokun is not known to have had the technical meaning to abjure, which is presupposed, and as we may well doubt whether the word elahu would immediately have evoked religious associations, be they either pagan or Christian. The most recent interpreters of the Pforzheim inscription have taken it to mean Aegil and Aldrun are searching for an elk, assuming it to be a charm that, I quote, was thought to make the wearer of the buckle a better hunter, end of quote. So I quote this as an excuse for showing you this beautiful cartoon, but I have to say otherwise I'm not convinced. The most likely interpretation, to my mind, is one which takes the line to be the opening of a secular epic poem, which does not really tell us anything about paganism or Christianity. The most likely candidate for a genuinely Christian runic inscription would seem to be this disc-shaped fibula discovered at Osthofen between Worms and Mainz, which is dated to the second half of the 7th century. Turning from an examination of individual objects to the graves as such, the most conspicuous development in the Christianization period is a change in the location of the wealthier graves. From the middle of the 5th century onwards, the Alamanni had been wont to bury their dead side by side in huge burial fields, whose regular layout suggests that individual graves were marked above ground and that the whole field was set off against its surroundings by something like a hedge or a fence. One of the largest and best known of these burial fields is that of Lauheim, excavated between 1986 and 1996. Where more than 1,300 individuals were buried between the second half of the 5th and the end of the 7th century. The graves of wealthy individuals are distinguished by more sumptuous grave goods or by a burial mound, but are in the main to be found within the confines of the field, although one of the last burial mounds in the southwest, that's to say to the right, appears to disregard the original boundary, as you can see in this reconstruction drawing. The village to which this burial field belonged was excavated between 1989 and 2005, from which it became clear that between 680 and 720, some 80 individuals were buried on the farmsteads where they had lived, mainly in groups numbering between 4 and 25 graves, as you can see in this reconstruction drawing. Overall, a burial on the farmstead appears to have been favoured by wealthy male individuals, as the grave goods tend to be well above average and there are hardly any children's graves. From a bird's eye perspective, what we see in Lauheim can also be observed in other places, for all over southwest Germany, wealthy individuals began to be buried outside of the great burial fields, either on their own farmsteads or in one of the early churches, from the early 7th century onwards. This tendency reached its zenith towards the end of the 7th century, by which time it appears to have become customary for wealthy individuals to be buried either in or near a church or on their own farmsteads. As far as can be judged from the grave goods, the decision between these two alternatives was not based on a difference in religious affiliation, for farmstead burials are just as likely to contain objects of a Christian character than those in or near a church. Turning now to the question of early churches, one should note at the outset that none of the church buildings that are still standing predate the Carolingian period. Some of the earliest, such as this one, St. Georg in Oberzell on the island of Reichenau in Lake Constance, dating to around 900. Thus, our knowledge of the earliest churches is based almost exclusively on the results of archaeological excavations, such as this one, conducted in the cemetery church of St. Peter and Paul at Nusplingen between 1979 and 2003. What you see here is a distribution map of the earliest churches marked in red colour, which can be dated to the 6th or 7th century. On the one hand, you can clearly see that the distribution of churches is roughly proportionate to the density of population, as there seem to be no early churches in areas with few settlements, such as the Black Forest or the region of Upper Swabia to the northeast of Lake Constance. On the other hand, there is no recognisable pattern of distribution that would allow us to reconstruct some sort of expansion, which suggests that the building of churches may have been due to local conditions rather than outside influences. Looking at individual church buildings, we may note that some of them were made of wood, that's numbers 1 to 4, and others of stone, numbers 5 to 8, all of them consisting of just one rectangular nave. Note also, especially in the case of numbers 3, 4 and 7, the large number of burials in or near a church, some of them with and others without grave goods. To the right, you can see two reconstruction drawings of the church of St. Martin at Pfullingen. This was originally a wooden church built presumably in the first decades of the 7th century, that's ground plan number 1, and this wooden church was subsequently turned into a stone church with an apse, which is ground plan number 5. Looking at St. Martin's Church in the town of Pfullingen today, we see that the late medieval successor of the 7th century church is still used as one of three Protestant parish churches. A similar story can be told of St. Martin's Church in the town of Kornwestheim, which goes back to a wooden church built in the 7th century. This is ground plan number 3. This too is still used as a Protestant church, the present late Gothic building dating to the early 16th century. Somewhat differently, St. Peter and Paul's church in Nusplingen, that's ground plans numbers 4 and 8, is only used as a cemetery church today. However, it was used as a parish church until 1759, when the parish church rights were transferred to the more centrally located St. Catherine's Church. In general, then, it looks as if the earliest churches were built at the instigation of, or at least with the approval of, the local nobility, who used them and their surroundings as burial places. Later, they were often turned into regular parish churches, catering for the local population who would bury their dead in the nearby cemetery. This transformation process was presumably accomplished with the help of the bishopric of Constance, which was set up in the early 7th century, and gradually came to encompass most of the area inhabited by the Alamanni. The progress made in this respect is thought to be reflected in the Lex Alamannorum, which is dated to the first half of the 8th century and, unlike the earlier Pactus Legis Alamannorum, presupposes the church as a ubiquitous, well-established and influential institution. In 746, Carloman crushed a revolt of Alamannic nobles, executing an unknown number of them in what came to be known as the Blood Court at Cannstatt, and for the next 100 years the Alamanni were ruled by Frankish dukes. During this period, the Carolingians consolidated both their rule and the Christianization of their empire. By the early 9th century, when the famous Stuttgart Psalter that you see here was created, southwest Germany was, to all intents and purposes, a thoroughly Christian country. In conclusion, I would now like to draw your attention to some questions which have occurred to me in dealing with the Alamannic material and which I suggest are of more general occurrence and wider significance. Firstly, how can Christian elements be identified in the archaeological record? Quite often, as in the cases of the Nordendorf fibula or the Heilfingen bronze disc, the answer is really based on a balancing of pros and cons, and the decision is by no means certain. This, I think, is not always taken into account, and sometimes one interpretation appears to be preferred for the simple reason that it fits an argument. Secondly, We may ask, what is the overall validity and significance of the evidence? For instance, when Ammianus Marcellinus tells us hardly anything about Alemannic religion, is that because he did not know about it, or is it because Alemannic paganism was not really significant, except on a very local level? Similarly, if there are no traces of sacrificial sites, does that mean that they were obliterated, quite possible, or does it mean that such sites never existed? The fact that so much of the evidence consists of grave goods raises yet another question, namely the extent to which such objects reflect the religious beliefs of the deceased or those of the community. Turning from these questions of source criticism to the Christianization process itself, we may proceed to ask, what does the evidence tell us about the psychological aspect of the Christianization? For instance, in one of the Oberflacht coffins decorated with a two-headed snake, there was in fact a silken cross that had been imported from the Byzantine or East Mediterranean area. Now, does that mean that the deceased person or the community held both Christian and pagan ideas? Or does the cross reflect the beliefs of one and the coffin those of the other? Similarly, if the Gutenstein sword sheath shows both a wolf warrior at the top and a cross at the bottom, does that imply a mixture or confusion of paganism and Christianity, either on the part of the craftsmen or on that of the owner? Although it is common to talk of syncretism in this context, one would in fact need to define the range of meanings that this term can imply. Turning from the individual to the community, we may ask, what does the evidence tell us of the sociological aspects of the Christianization? What appears to be clear is that the conversion process went hand in hand with one of social stratification, and that Christianity was by and large supported by the nobility. What one would like to know, but what is difficult to know, is how the rest of the society responded to this change, and how long the old religion was still held to be a serious alternative. Immediately related to this problem is yet another question. What does the evidence tell us about the political aspects of the Christianization? As the numerous gold leaf crosses found in southwest Germany reflect a custom that was introduced into the area from Longobardic Italy, it is perhaps significant that they were not used by those Alemanni who chose to bury their dead in or by a church. Does that difference in usage perhaps reflect different Christian parties? And does it imply that the early churches were more closely associated with those who were inspired by Frankish rather than Longobardic models? Quite possible. And that seems to be the explanation that is favoured now. Even more difficult is the question, what does the evidence tell us about the legal and institutional aspects of the Christianization? Here, the lack of written documents is especially painful, but one must, of course, be wary of projecting the conditions of a later period into that of the Christianization itself. So, the final question is, how should we proceed in view of all these problems? Now, firstly, I think we should try to avoid what the historian of religions, Walter Bethge, once called the horror vacui. That is to say, we should not feel uneasy about admitting our own ignorance and resist the temptation of filling all blanks in our knowledge by starting from questionable assumptions, drawing rash inferences, or making glib generalizations. Secondly, I think the complex nature of many problems shows that any single investigator should try to know as much as possible about archaeology, philology, social anthropology, comparative religious studies, church history, and medieval Christian theology, both with a view to the present state of knowledge and, of course, the history of scholarship. And as none of us can claim to be competent in all of these fields, I would argue that interdisciplinary discussions are absolutely vital, which is, of course, why conferences such as this one are so important. Thank you very much for your attention.